right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've got a packed show. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with the folks from the 24th Street Theater about a new play they have out running, and it's called Lady Bird. And they're going to be in studio to talk with us about this show, its significance, its importance. Before that, we'll be talking with a student from San Jose State University and Dr. Ruth Wilson, the chair of the African American Studies Department at San Jose State University. And we'll be talking about what the hell is going on at San Jose State when you have these atrocious racist assaults, and I'm sure a lot of people know about, and we'll be talking about a lot more in terms of what's happening there, what's the situation there, and what are people doing about it. And our first segment of the show, we're going to be talking with Annie Day, the producer of a concert back in 2011 and the director of a new film called Stepping Into the Future. And we're going to be talking about that film, and we're going to be talking with Annie and two participants in the April 2011 event, Maggie Brown, singer and educator, and Richard Brown, former Black Panther, member of the San Francisco 8, who the system has been trying to frame for killing a cop for many, many decades now. And a revolutionary up in San Francisco, we'll be talking with him about the entire film. But opening the show up, I really felt compelled this morning to read something that I think is extremely important based on the idea on what's been going on around the death of Nelson Mandela. And I'll be real quick with this, and it means we're going to have to shave a couple minutes off of the entire program, so we'll split that up among the people that we're interviewing, but it's just that important, all right? And you can find this these 5 points of orientation at the site revcom.us, and there'll be further analysis, an article on Mandela and South Africa and what happened there. But right now, I think it's extremely important, as everybody's talking about this, that this statement be something that people wrestle with, all right? On the death of Nelson Mandela, 5 points of orientation. On December 5th, 2013, Nelson Mandela died at the age of 95. The vicious system of apartheid, blatant racist, brutal oppression and discrimination against Black and other non-white peoples in South Africa, which Nelson Mandela struggled against, was part of a legacy of centuries of the most horrific plunder of Africa as a whole by the capitalist world. In South Africa, after World War II, apartheid further institutionalized and intensified that vicious oppression. Black and other non-white South Africans were locked down in prison-like Bantustans without the most basic necessities of life, things like clean water or decent shelter. They were treated as non-humans, subject to fascist pass laws that govern their every movement. On the backs of their labor, white settlers lived the lifestyles of Northern Europe and global capitalism imperialism accumulated massive profits. Nelson Mandela emerged as an opponent of the apartheid system in the 1950s. He joined the rising tide of courageous, widespread struggle among many different sections of people in South Africa that went up against the whips, clubs, guns, and torture chambers of the regime. For this, he was sentenced to a life of hard labor in prison, and he never backed down in his opposition to apartheid. The struggle against apartheid became a cause that inspired people around the world. Many people gave their lives in this struggle, and Nelson Mandela became the most prominent symbol of that struggle. But the powers that be are not praising Mandela because of his role as an opponent of apartheid, but because he conciliated with the forces of the old order and played a key role in dismantling apartheid in a way that didn't excavate, but in the main, reinforced the historic and horrific oppression of the Black and other non-white people of South Africa. Whatever Mandela's intent, his outlook of embrace the enemy, which is being so extolled by the powers that be in their eulogies, went directly against the need to uproot all the political, structural, economic, social, and cultural relations that formed the foundation for that system. We have to have the honesty to confront the reality of the path Nelson Mandela charted. It did not lead to freedom for the oppressed people in South Africa. The vast majority of people in South Africa continue to suffer in the grip of global capitalism imperialism. Today, 2 decades after Mandela became the first Black president of South Africa, the situation for the masses of Black people in South Africa remains horrendous. South Africa is one of the world's most unequal societies. Over half the population of South Africa lives in extreme poverty. The only source of water for 1.4 million children is dirty, disease-ridden streams. Immigrant workers from poorer countries in Africa are subjected to violent attacks. Conditions for women who played such a heroic role in the battle against apartheid are abysmal. South Africa has the highest rate of rape in the world, and perhaps the most heartbreaking consequence of all, people have been left demoralized. seeing all this as more proof that the fundamental change in society is not possible. That is not the case. But it is the case that nothing short of uprooting exploitation and oppression can free the people of South Africa or anywhere else. The wretched of the earth have made revolution and started on the road to communism, a society free of all oppression, first in Russia and then in China. They achieved great things before these revolutions were turned back. And not only has this been done before, it can be done again, and even better this time. I urge everyone reading this to get their hands on a special issue of Revolution. You don't know what you think you know about the Communist Revolution and the real path to emancipation, its history, and our future. And to get into as well the work of Bob Avakian, and you can do both of that at revcom.us. So that's a little commentary on Mandela, and we'll be talking more about that in the weeks to come. Now, I want to welcome to the show Annie Day. As I said, Annie was the producer of just a remarkable concert that was happened back in April of 2011. And it was around the theme of, on the occasion of the publication of Basics, and for people that don't know, Basics is the new revolutionary handbook. It's a collection of things drawn from the work of Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. So it was on the occasion of the publication of Basics, a celebration of revolution and the vision of a new world. And Annie's here to talk with us about a film on that event. Annie, how are you? Welcome to the show.
I'm good. Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, tell people about this event.
Well, okay, the film that's about this event is called Stepping into the Future. On the occasion of the publication of Basics, a celebration of revolution and the vision of a new world. And the event itself took place in April 2011 in Harlem. And, when we, a group of revolutionaries, knew that Basics was going to be coming out, this is the book of quotations and essays from the work of Bob Avakian culled over, from over 30 years. When we knew this was going to be coming out, we were thinking about it really needed some kind of celebration. And so we contacted a bunch of different kinds of people, activists, revolutionaries, artists, and we pulled together a host committee of people who put their heads together and said, okay, we need to have a whole range of voices coming together, bouncing off of the revolutionary vision, the new synthesis of communism that Avakian has developed, bouncing off of that, but also coming from their own perspectives and celebrating revolution and the vision of a whole new world. So it was dancers and poets, musicians, young and old, a whole range of people from the 1960s who had come forward back in the day, but also a lot of young people who were really excited about the idea of celebrating revolution. Some of them are people who are more partisan to Avakian, really feel like what he's brought forward is what the world needs most of all. And then there were other people who felt like, okay, I really dig this and really feel like it needs to be a point of reference in society, even if they're coming from a different perspective. But that was all part of the juice that went into, this night that really, was a night of great joy and where you could really taste a different way the world could be, different way people could relate, and really a whole new culture that would both feed into that and that would be encouraged in a whole different society.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, and I think this is something that the film brings out very well, and we're going to talk about that in a minute, but one of the things that it actually gave people a sense of, when you looked at this, there were so many people, as you're saying, from so many different perspectives that came into this, all kinds of beliefs and opinions and ways of expressing them. And yet there was this central theme. And it was really interesting to me to see, that, and I was fortunate enough to actually talk to a lot of the people who participated in it, interviewed them, and watched the event as it happened. And it really struck me, and it became even more so in having watched the film. And, the idea that there was something new and different that came together there, that you had all these people, and yet there was this central theme that they were united around. You had all these people with these various opinions. How did that play out? How did that become, how did the event actually become that kind of whole that was, that was greater than the sum of its parts?
Well, I think that's a good question. It had everything to do with kind of the most revolutionary radical core that was at the heart of it, which was an introduction to Avakian. Basics, like you said in the intro, it's a handbook for revolution for today. And it says on the back of the book, you can't change the world if you don't know the basics. And this is a book that really kind of distills together the most essential questions of revolution and human emancipation and provides a guide for that. So this was really the heart of this event and at the core of it, and as well as an introduction to, just a quick divergence, one of the things people have commented about the film is we show some of the historical footage, some of the archival film of Avakian, which also ran through the cultural event on the night of. And this, you know, so through the whole, when one of the things people said is that it's kind of neat that people don't know Avakian's history from the 1960s working with the Black Panther Party, but also persevering on the revolutionary road today. So this is, you know, this was at the core of this. And then that provided, you know, you have the most revolutionary, most scientific, most radical understanding of what's the problem in the world and the way out. That provides then a lot to bounce off of. And on that, on the kind of basis of that solid core was the flourishing of a lot of elasticity, if you want to put it that way, which is a theme that runs through Avakian's work, a solid core with a lot of elasticity. So this night was an expression of that. And, you know, it brought out a lot of the revolutionary edge of different kinds of people, but also their appreciation from their perspective of that revolutionary edge. And then there was a lot of, you know, feeling like that people were in this together, that they were there for something bigger than themselves. That one of the people who is in the film is an actor and a comedian. His name is Aladdin. And he said, you know, there was no ego. People came because they were about something. There was no, they weren't there for the bling bling. They were about, you know, the emancipation. They were there about the emancipation of humanity, and that forged something new through all this.
And it really was striking. And it's one of the things that really I really was struck by in the film itself. And the film, by the way, we're talking with Annie Day, and Annie's a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and she's also a co-director of a new film called Stepping Into the Future, on the occasion of the publication of Basics, a celebration of revolution and the vision of a new world. You know, it really is true that you got a sense when you know, through the film, especially when people were talking about, in the interviews that were conducted for the film, people were talking about, in retrospect, sort of what they were feeling and how people were there for a much bigger thing. And that was something that really, really stood out for me. You really got a sense of how things could look. And I'm going to ask you that question, so I'll prep you for it now. I'm going to ask you the question in a minute about Stepping Into the Future, the title, and what that means. But I want to bring on a couple of the people that were in the film, part of the event, and give them a chance to speak for a couple minutes about this, and then I'll come back to you. Let's talk with Maggie Brown. Maggie Brown is a singer, actress, educator, and an all-around nice person. You knew I was going to say that, Maggie. There you go. Okay.
No, I sure didn't. Okay. Hey, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good.
Annie, yeah. Annie, you're so articulate, and you were on the film as well. It was really something. It was a really great thing to be a part of, and I'm actually floored at how much participation I have in the film. I'm honored, you know.
Well, what made you want to be part of the event in the first place?
Well, I was asked by my cousin, Dred Scott Tyler, and we saw each other in New York a couple weeks before, and he said, you know, you should try to come back for this. It's a big deal, and you know, it would be great to have your voice there. And so I said, sure, I would love to. And, you know, folks at RevCom Books in New York worked it out so that I could come back, and I did. And, man, it was way bigger than, you know, what I realized. But I knew it was going to be big, but, you know, you don't really know what to expect. But it was a flourishing. It was just people getting on the one, you know, that's the thing. We have to get on the one around something that like makes sense, you know, that makes sense for the whole more so. And so that it just made sense to come and lend my voice to that, because I definitely want to change. It was intriguing, something that was about, you know, a vision of a new world and revolution, because I feel that's what's needed.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I have to tell people that you did something at the event that was just, just grabbed everybody's heart. You did a medley, basically. You opened up with A Change Is Going to Come, and then you sort of took everybody's breath away when you went to Nina Simone's I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free, which just was a remarkable combination, and really, I thought, captured a lot of the essence of a part of what was going on that night. Now, you mentioned the thing about this being big and being about revolution, and, you know, this other thing, and being about revolution and then being about a new world, and knowing that, you know, a big part of what was running through that was the vision of a new world and communism in relation to Bob Avakian and his work and what's actually needed for the world. But you came into this from your own perspective about a new world. And I wanted to know what you know, because you comment a lot about this in the film. You comment about what really brought you to this, you know, what your vision of the world is today and why a thing like revolution is needed.
What brought me to this? Let's see. I guess, you know, some is my upbringing because, you know, it's kind of like I said it on this album we did. I end up saying I was born into this position, and that really my grandfather, you know, he was part of some black intelligentsia at the time in the 20s that was fighting for a 49th state. And we know that my father, Oscar Brown Jr., that was Oscar Brown Sr. And so Oscar Brown Jr., he ended up being one that ushered in, you know, what maybe we now think of as Afrocentricity as relates to, you know, an expression in the arts that, you know, that helped encourage that stand up, I'm black and I'm proud thing that started happening in our music in the 60s. And so I was really born into this, you know, and almost, it's almost by osmosis, you know, that these things happen, that my path keeps leading me to, you know, it's my desire. As I grew up, you know, I knew I wanted to be famous and hear my music back coming back at me in the radio, and I wanted to make the, you know, the television shows and have to do the nighttime shows and become popular. But I always knew that I wanted to bring a certain message. And it turns out that by wanting to bring that certain message, oh, no, you can't. You're not going to get a deal. You're not going to get on the shows. You know, if anything, you'll be silenced. But I keep finding my way to groups of people that, you know, that of like mind. And, you know, I'm very grateful for that. And I'm grateful, you know, you talked about those songs. I was really pleased with that medley, with doing those two things. It felt so good getting it prepared. I knew it would be enjoyed. And then I felt sort of bad because, you know, it was at the beginning of the night and there weren't many people there. And by the end of the night, it was so packed. I was like, wow. Well, oh well, man. And then I get the film. I get to see the film in Chicago, and man, I see how much I'm in it. It's like, oh no, child, don't worry nothing about that. Your presence wasn't felt. That your contribution didn't make a difference to this occasion, and it's a big deal.
Mm-hmm. All right, Maggie, we'll come back to you in a little bit, but I want to move over to Richard Brown, and I want to let people know, for people that don't know, that Richard Brown is a former Panther up in the Senate, and he's a member of the San Francisco 8, a group of revolutionaries of Panthers who were framed by the police, by the system, decades ago, and they continue to try and frame them for, you know, on the charges of murdering a cop. And Richard is someone who has never backed down, and I think this is extremely important in relation to what's going on in the world today. And he also exhorts people to actually stand up and look at what's going on and to act accordingly. Richard, welcome to the show.
To Annie and Maggie.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Richard.
Hey. Hi.
Richard, tell me something. I'd ask you the same question. Why did you participate in an event? What made you want to participate in this event, this celebration of this, you know, an occasion of the publication of Basics, celebration of revolution and the vision of the new world? Go ahead.
One of the things is because I'm fortunate enough to have known of Bob Avakian back in the day when, as we referred to it, and the fact that he has remained a strong warrior all these years, which is something I respect and admire greatly. And reading the book, which I was fortunate enough to be able to do, I also come to the conclusion that it reminded me a lot of the Red Book, in which the Black Panther Party used in order to educate a community and to educate the Panthers back during the 60s. And I am a firm believer in educating the people so that we can bring about a change, which is desperately needed. So I was wondering, it was just a continuation of everything that I've been doing ever since the 60s and pushing for a better world and a new world. And I know that in order to be able to do that, you have to educate the masses.
Well, one of the things that you did that was very moving was, and when you spoke at the event, you and this is captured in the film as well, so people can get a fuller taste of it in the film. But you made you put out a challenge to the audience as a whole, to people as a whole, but with particular emphasis on youth. And it was related to your belief that a revolution is needed. And can we talk about that challenge you put out to people and to the youth?
Well, I challenge the youth whenever I speak and whenever I go. I don't remember exactly what I said that night, but it should have been that this is their world and it's going to be what they make of it. And I wanted them to unite and come together and do the best that they could to try to bring about a change.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that you had, you were really, you know, and again, I think this thing about the, you know, the vision of the world of what do you think it would take to actually change the world? I mean, because there was the point about on this occasion of this publication of Basics and the celebration of revolution and a vision of a new world. What did you think about that latter part of the thing too?
the celebration of the new world?
The vision of a new world, the celebration of revolution and the vision of a new world.
Well, I mean, I honestly believe that, first of all, you know, we just have to come together, and there is a vision of the new world. That whole night was magical, and I was able to get to be inspired by everything and everyone that I saw there, including the people in the audience. I mean, it was really a magical night. Everyone there was united and so warm and on one page, we were moving forward trying to come up with something that will enable all of us to be able to work together to bring about a change.
Mm-hmm. All right, Richard, I'm going to...
Basic is one of the tools that I think that can be used in order to do that.
Okay, great. Okay, real quick, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking today with Annie Day, who is the co-director of a new film called Stepping Into the Future on the occasion of the publication of Basics, a celebration of revolution and the vision of a new world. And it's a film about a cultural event that happened back in April of 2011. And it was an event that was built around the same theme. And we're also talking with Maggie Brown, educator, actress, and singer, and Richard Brown, former Black Panther and former member of the, or current, still member of the San Francisco 8, a group of Panthers that were framed by the system for supposedly murdering a cop. And to this day, Richard remains part of the revolutionary movement. And both Maggie and Richard were part of the original event and are also among the artists featured in the film. Annie, let's get back to you and ask you this question. I know when I've watched the film, and a lot of other people who I watched it with actually saw this and said, you know, geez, this is kind of a, this is like walking into a whole new world. And the title of the film is Stepping Into the Future. Let's talk about that. Why that title? What does it mean? Explain it.
Well, you know, we are up against a nightmare of a world. And, you know, the mass suffering and deep immiseration of people all around the world, brutal exploitation, people's lives cut down way too young, impoverishment, you know, and the words can't describe it, frankly. But in going up against that, I mean, one, it doesn't have to be this way. It's because of this way, because of a system, not because of human nature, but because of a system of capitalism. And a different system can be brought into being and is possible. It's going to take a revolution. And in fighting for that revolution and coming together to celebrate that, there is tremendous joy. And there's tremendous heart that people take from each other. You hear it in Maggie's voice and Richard's voice and people talking about what it means to come together and to envision that world. And here, you know, for a night and what this film captures, but also foreshadowing the potential for a whole new world and the movement for revolution that's being built today, you see that kind of, stepping into whole new ways of relating, stepping into a whole different kind of culture, the coming together of people of a whole range of ages, diversity, different cultural backgrounds, different life experiences, and coming together and building something new in connection to the work of Avakian and somebody who has dedicated his life to this and being about something that really is truly emancipatory. It's serious. It's not easy, but it's, you know, a source of tremendous joy. And actually, Cornel West, who was interviewed in the film, says, you know, it's what I call revolutionary joy, which is very different than capitalist pleasure. And I think the film captures that, and it also captures the impact it could have now if Avakian's work was known. If there's a campaign, BA Everywhere, imagine the difference it could make. And you also get a sense there, BA meaning Bob Avakian. You also get a sense in this film of what difference it can make now in the world in terms of that joy, in terms of that feeling of people actually like, okay, we're stepping into the future. Forget all of this mess that we're being forced to live in.
Right, exactly. Now, we're running up on our time, and I want to make sure that people know the film is Stepping Into the Future on the occasion of the publication of Basics, a celebration of revolution and the vision of a new world. And it's the story of the 2011 celebration of the release of Bob Avakian's book, Basics, at the Harlem Stage in New York City. So let me tell you, some of the people you'll be seeing, featuring performances and interviews with Matthew Shipp and William Parker, two great jazz musicians, David Murray, another great jazz musician, Reggie Gaines, poet and playwright, Maluka Mala, hip-hop artist, Abiodun Oyewale from the Last Poets, Outer National, the band Outer National, Maggie Brown, Guillermo Brown, Moist Paula Henderson, Aladdin, and many others, including interviews with Richard Brown, Dr. Cornel West, Annie Day, Carl Dix, a number of other people, and including also archival footage of Bob Avakian throughout the years, you know, different periods of his life as a revolutionary leader. And you get to see him and as he developed and as he and the journey that he's taken all the way through this, a journey of revolution. You don't want to miss this film, folks. This is a great film. I'm telling you, every time I've seen it and everybody I've seen it with has just loved it. And if you want to find out more about the film in general, go to revcom.us. If you want to order a DVD for yourself or be part of setting up a showing in your city, in your state, in your wherever you are, then you should write directly to Revolution Books. Go to Revolution Books. Go to their website. It's www.revolutionbooksnyc.com. Okay, again, that's www.revolutionbooksnyc.org. And I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Richard, Maggie, both of you two, thank you very much for joining us today and hope to talk to you all again soon.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Richard, Maggie.
Okay, take care now.
Take care, y'all.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking about what the hell is going on at San Jose State University and what does it say about this system and all the people that tolerate this stuff. So stay tuned.
The Mississippi River,
Lord, Lord, Lord,
Lord. In the Mississippi River,
Lord, 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 Lord.
In the Mississippi River, well, now you can count them one by one.
It could be your
and
son.
You can count them two by two.
It could be me
and
or you.
You can count them three by three.
Now don't you wanna
and
see?
You can count them four by four.
Oh well, a hen to the river they go. Oh well, a hen to the river they go.
Then you can count them five by five.
Now they don't come out alive.
Now you can count them six by
all right,
six.
Welcome back. That's In the Mississippi River with by Mavis Staples. All right, just a very heavy song, and I think one that's very fitting for our next conversation. In late November, the world found out that a young black student, a freshman at San Jose State University, had been subjected to horrific racist abuse. Having a U-lock bicycle lock placed around his neck, called racist names and locked in his rooms by his roommates, and all the time living with fellow students, white students, who scrawled the word, and let's be as ugly as it actually is, who scrawled the word nigger, hung up a Confederate flag, and placed a picture of Hitler. They displayed a picture of Hitler in their common space. This went on for months. Living in this situation for months with these bunch of Neanderthal morons. And a number of authorities actually knew about this. And despite a complaint by the black students' parents, the white students it went on and on and on. And the white students have now been charged with misdemeanor hate crimes. All right, folks, this is the best of all possible worlds, right? Post-racial America, yeah. Joining us to talk about this is Gary Daniels. Gary is a member of Black Unity, and he's a student at San Jose State University. And we're also joined by Dr. Ruth Wilson, chair of the African American Studies Department at San Jose State University. Let's start with Gary Daniels. Gary, welcome to the show.
Hello, everyone. How you doing?
Good, good. Although every time I talk about what happened there, my stomach just turns up, and I just want to stand up and start screaming. So let's jump into this. What is the situation facing black students at San Jose State today? You know, this laid out a certain scene of what faces black students at San Jose State. How much is this a sign of what is going on overall at the university? What is the situation facing black students at San Jose State today?
The situation facing black students at San Jose State is one of zero support from the institution, isolation, sense of abandonment, sense that we don't matter, sense that our voices aren't heard. But in a sense, that last part about our voices not being heard, that's pretty much 99% of our university at this point.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was something that what was your reaction? What was your personal reaction when you heard about what happened to this young freshman?
My personal reaction was I felt my heart drop to my stomach. I knew that it could have been me. I lived in that building as a freshman. It was the greatest time of my life. That student had the total opposite experience. But I knew, based on the fact that we've been trying to raise issues of African-American students apart from San Jose State for a while, I knew that something needed to be done immediately by the students to let administration know that the time is now to make changes, that this type of, I guess, lack of support, lack of attention can't continue. Otherwise, these incidents are going to continue.
Mm-hmm. What was the overall student reaction when word got out about what had happened in that dorm?
Shock, outrage, sense of, like, how could something like this happen? Well, people who've been aware of San Jose State's governance, you know, weren't too surprised that something like this could happen, but we were shocked that it took this point for them to actually want to make changes.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this. You were at a rally protesting this, and you were part of the people that were wearing tape over your mouths. What was this rally about, and why the tape?
Again, 99% of our campus has no say, no voice in its governance. It's a total top-down management structure, management style that's been going on. So, you know, most of the semester, black students were fighting to save our African-American Studies Department from being canceled. From being cut. The university was essentially not trying to hear us. And then last semester, a student wrote that Black History Month was abandoned in the school newspaper. You know, we're trying to let the university know something was wrong here. They didn't want to listen. So the tape was to just show, you know, we might as well not have a voice on this campus. We don't.
Well, let me remind listeners that we're talking, this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Gary Daniels from San Jose State University, and we're talking about the recent racist atrocity that happened on the campus and the response to that from the students and other people. And joining us in the conversation as well is Dr. Ruth Wilson, who's the chair of the African American Studies Department. Ruth, welcome to the show.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, good. Although every time I think about this and read about this, I just feel really slimy as hell. You know, it's just a terrible, terrible, you know, and it's true. I think what Gary just said, your heart drops to your stomach, but then your brain's on fire if you have any heart, any conscience about what's going on. And I wanted to ask you this. You know, the university, the people who basically run the university have said that they didn't know, that they were really sort of in the dark, you know, and then this basically want to, you know, as I said in the beginning of the show, what was going on with this in terms of what happened, the kind of the assault on this freshman, on this black freshman by, you know, I guess it was, in the beginning he had 7 white roommates. I don't know how many it ended up being, but the general point is that he was assaulted viciously in a racist assault that involved all kinds of atrocious things. The lock around his neck, anybody who's seen a picture of slavery knows exactly what that's about. The Confederate flag hanging up there in his dorm room in the common area. The pictures of Hitler, they're calling him, oh God, they're calling him, nicknaming him Three Fists or Fraction, symbolizing the, or referring to the, you know, that the U.S. ruling that black people back then were three fifths of a person. You know, this is the, you know, that all that kind of stuff going on. Now, here's the thing. The university says, and I have to ask you this, Ruth, and I know you might not want to comment on this, but how the hell does a man get to be president of a university when he can actually stand up there and say, I didn't really know what the Confederate flag stood for? You know, and you're thinking, wait a minute, this is the president of the university, but it really follows a whole pattern where they're saying, we didn't really know, we weren't aware, we didn't have any idea that the situation was really that bad. What's the story there? What's real there and what isn't?
I think what's real is, on one hand, we state we welcome diversity, but we have not invested in building a community that is supportive of a diverse, you know, community, a diverse campus. And that means we have to orientate students when they come that we are honoring diversity and not just talking about it. That means we have conversations on what it means to be a good citizen. If you have 7 young men in a room, what happens when one of them feels, you know, set aside and tortured? Others remain silent, and others continue the torturing. That's not a community. That's not a community that supports diversity. Those people don't belong on a campus. that supports diversity. So on one hand, it shows that in these this time of budget crunch, we have been focusing on our budget, but not on the whole picture, the community of students that come here, of faculty who come here. We're not talking and working systematically on dealing with issues that create a society that is complex, intelligent, and sensitive to the divisions and the places where we overlap and agree. So it's really important that we invest in supporting a diverse culture, a diverse climate on campus. And there has been a study done by Susan Murray on the campus that showed where these issues were, which issues were of concern for various groups. And we have not addressed those issues. We need to address those. We need to put our money and our time where our mouths are, where our websites say we are. And we need to do it with full steam ahead. Instead of cutting back on programs and departments that really focus on these issues, we need to be more supportive of them, more inclusive of them, and really, you know, just own up to the fact that we are a complex society, and we have to make sure when we bring people on that campus that they understand that they have to be citizens of San Jose State, and they have to understand what we say and what we mean, and they have to be a part of our community as full-fledged, honorable citizens.
Well, let me ask you this, Ruth.
It's not honorable.
All right, let me ask you this, Ruth. You mentioned this study that was done, and I have to say, I mean, and you put this in the overall context where you have, you know, when you talk about diversity at San Jose State, you know, there's like 3.3% of black people or 3.6% to 4% are the student population at San Jose State are black people. Very tiny. 3.3% at UCLA. And I think I actually heard something recently that there were only 50 black people in the incoming class at UCLA this year. You know, you look at this kind of thing, and then you look at what this report that you mentioned, you know, talked about. And the students that were interviewed in this report said that there was an ever-present expectation that because of their skin color, they weren't likely to measure up, a feeling that others expected them to speak for their whole race and about racial stereotypes, a sense of racist treatment. One student said a professor refused to recognize her raised hand and later called on a white student, and that black athletes felt criticized for wearing certain kinds of their low-slung pants and hats while similarly attired white teammates in the same group were left alone. It gives you a taste of what the hell is going on broadly on the campus. And this report, it wasn't just not following what was suggested there, but the report was basically, I understand that when Susan Murray when she wrote the report, she got an email saying, we're not interested, we're not going to put it on our website. And the only reason this has even come up is, like, you know, Gary Daniels was one of the students that stumbled onto it and happened to read, holy hell, this is what we're talking about. What about
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. That was their voices, and their voices were not prioritized. The study was not prioritized. Mm-hmm.
Well, is there an attack? Is there an assault on the, you know, Gary mentioned this. Is there an assault on the Afro-American Studies Department right now?
There has been a neglect of not only African-American studies, but other ethnic studies departments and programs on the campus. It's often portrayed as an issue of demand, that students aren't demanding the course, therefore it is not needed anymore. It needs to rethink, refocus, and so forth. But if we look very carefully, what a demand is often pushed and led by people with resources who want to create demand, and they don't necessarily want to do things that will enhance our civility on the campus. That's my perspective. But it is our responsibility as educators to pay attention to the factors that promote civility on a campus, regardless of what major you choose. The civility of society is essential for sustaining a country, a nation, an institution. So we have to really rethink why these ethnic studies programs are underfunded and put aside easily, and not really addressing the issues until things are desperate. So it's a very complex issue, but there are some very simple solutions. If we're going to be a diverse society, and we are, we have to put things in place to support diversity. We have to make sure our students on the campus understand what we stand for, and we cannot do that by putting aside a study that we invested in as a campus, faculty, students, administrators, staff, invested in the study. We need to actualize it. We need action.
Okay, real quick, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Gary Daniels, a student at San Jose University in California, and Dr. Ruth Wilson, the chair of the African-American Studies Department at San Jose State University, and we're talking about the horrible, atrocious, racist assault against a black freshman by seven of his white dorm mates, and an assault that is just unspeakably ugly. Now, tell me this, and this is the last question for both of you, so I'll start with you first, Ruth. The question is, if you're not doing that, what does it say? Because this is something that really, really hits at me. When you're looking at what has been in all the various forms of denial or of justification, even as they're sort of condemning with faint, you know, faint sort of horror, they're sort of like, really, this whole thing, like, you look at this, do you see any connection between this? And yes, as you said, it's a diverse society at San Jose State, as well as in the country as a whole. It's a diverse society. But you know what? There's a certain system, a systematic enforcement of oppression of people, particularly people of various different nationalities, black, Latino, Asian, all these things going on like that, as people being condemned for their sexuality, all the stuff that's happening to women, you know, all of this. Do you see any connection between what's going on with black people in the population as a whole and the kind of allowance for the the idea that this kind of behavior could just sort of go along unopposed in a certain sense for long periods of time? You know, what do you see any connection between that and the idea that, for instance, a young black woman can be in a car accident and have her cell phone broken at 2 o'clock in the morning, knock on somebody's house, a white guy answers the door and says, yeah,
right,
yeah,
right.
Well, do you see any connection between that?
There are connections. When we don't pay attention to what is going on at the civil level, things fall apart. We could easily move from, you know, the perception of a comfortable society where we're all accepting each other to barbarianism, chaos, very easily. And what went on in that suite was chaos. Students were there who did not report the crime. Students were there victimized by the crime but afraid to speak out because they were afraid they'd be victimized even more. And students who were terrorizing the victim were triumphant in what they were doing. And we are, by reducing the issue to a misdemeanor, society is telling all black people that it's really just a prank.
Mm-hmm.
They really didn't mean it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really what you think it is.
Right. Come on.
That just isn't true.
Right. Come on. Can't you take a joke? What's the matter with you? You know, that's exactly what they're saying.
There's been a swastika up there. Yeah. DA, do not believe, would have been trying to sidestep the issue.
Right. And so people know that these students have been charged with misdemeanor hate crimes. And there's a big an outcry from a lot of people that it should be.
For good reason.
Yeah, exactly.
They know
exactly that
next time somebody gets lynched, somebody's going to say, oh, it was an accident.
Right.
He didn't
right.
really mean to do that. They were just playing around.
Right, you know? Right, exactly. All right, Ruth, on that note, we're really pressed for time. So I'm going to have to, you know, just thank you for being here. And really, you know what? I'd say one thing, too, though. This entire society is run by barbarians. And, you know, we're struggling to get rid of that now.
I disagree. I think these are people. And we can approach people with a plan for how we're going to live civilly in this society.
Okay, well, that's something we'll have to talk about a little bit later, because I think we need to live civilly in society, but it's going to take a whole nother society. So I want to thank you very much for joining us today, Ruth.
Have a good day.
Okay, you too. And Gary, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Okay, take care now. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with the director, cast member, and one of the people from the 24th Street Theater talking about their latest play, Lady Bird. So stay tuned.
There's a trail of tears, a new trail of death. The vigilantes and coyotes watch the sunset in the borderland with the rattlesnakes. No. tenemos nada, que queremos todo el mundo, que tenemos nada, que queremos todo el mundo, que tenemos nada, que queremos todo el mundo, que tenemos nada, que queremos todo el mundo.
All right, welcome back. That's Outer National with Kay Queremos. All right, and joining us today, I'm really happy to have these guys in the studio, because even though we're rushed for time, I'm not going to spend a lot of time introducing them, except to say that they're some of the finest people that I've met in a long time, because just the little few times I've had interactions with them, I've always been impressed with what they're doing. And what they're doing now at the 24th Street Theater, they have a new production called Lady Bird, and it's a production that was produced with the residents of the neighborhood. It's a very powerful. Well, I'll let them tell you about it. And I want to welcome to the show. And I'm sitting here and I'm looking and I'm thinking, okay, because my mind is just wandering everywhere today, the director of the new play, Laurie Woolery. Laurie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
The theater director overall, Jay McAdams, who has stormed his way back into the studio.
Whenever I can.
Right. How you doing, Jay? And an actor and neighborhood resident, the lead in the play, Yvonne Rodriguez. Yvonne, welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you.
Sure. Well, let's jump into it. Why don't we talk, Laurie, to you first. Tell people what the play is about.
Well, starting in April of this year, we had done story circles with the neighborhood, the residents of North University Park, and gathered stories about what was on their mind, their hearts, their souls, and basically have created a play inspired by and using the words and the stories of that community. And that is Lady Bird.
Now, that process of collecting stories, that process, I mean, it's really interesting, because you actually talked, as I understand, it was a long period of time that you gathered up so many stories. And from people I've talked to who were there or who heard about it or whatever, said it was a very gut-wrenching and emotional time for people.
It's an incredible process, because people have been sitting around in circles since the dawn of time, sharing stories of their lives and their days and their experiences. So for me, I feel like we're coming from a very ancient tradition. But in our very fast-paced world, in the world of tweeting and Facebooking, we shortcut that. And so going back to the basics of sitting in a circle of people listening to one another, witnessing the stories, is incredibly powerful.
Well, the thing is, too, is there's a theme to Lady Bird, right? I mean, it's a...
Absolutely. I mean, initially, when Jay and Debbie and I were talking about doing a Christmas show with the neighborhood, Jay came up with the idea of using perhaps the gift of the Magi. But what we did is we looked at the themes about that surrounding that O. Henry story, which is about family and sacrifice and love, deep, deep love, and just formulated questions to ask the community based on those themes. And because their families, many of them are immigrants or first generation, you get those stories of sacrifice, firsthand experiences, and we kind of have done our own version of that with Lady Bird.
Now let me move to Yvonne. Yvonne has emerged from the neighborhood now as the lead actor in the play. Yvonne, welcome to the show again, man.
Thank you. Wow, you make me sound so interesting.
No. I think you do that to yourself, sister. Okay. Let's talk about that, because you were you participated in this circle of storytelling.
Yes, I was fortunate enough to be in the circle with people that I knew and already admired. And I was able to listen to their wonderful stories of heroism, is what I really think it is, and just get that much closer to them, so I can call many of them great friends.
Well, let's talk about this. What exactly was that, when you talked about heroism in their stories? What were some of the themes of the stories that particularly struck you?
Well, most of us are first generation. Are immigrants from various Latino countries, and the struggle that they had coming here into a whole different environment, learning a language, raising their children. I saw my parents do the same thing, but realizing that the synonymous element in all of this was that struggle, and just moving forward and doing it with love and appreciating the lessons that come with these struggles and these sacrifices, as Lori said, was just created this energy in the circle that I was able to just, you know, grab onto and carry with me, and I still do.
Mm-hmm. And one thing about that is the sacrifice that families made, women specifically, about leaving their children behind in order to come here to get money in order to send it home and to find ways of bringing them over. You know, immigration gets a bad rap, especially here in Southern California. Mm-hmm. And so to put faces and hear firsthand accounts of decisions leading up to that and experiences of being here gives a face to immigration that other news stories and things don't necessarily provide us.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think it's really important. Now, Jay, one of the things is this is sort of a, when you get down to the way that this play was actually brought together, this is sort of like a foundational point for the 24th Street Theater, isn't it?
Right. Exactly. It's bringing community literally onto the stage.
Okay, real quick, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm Michael Slate. And we're talking today with Lori Woolery, Yvonne Rodriguez, and Jay McAdams from the 24th Street Theater in Los Angeles. And we're talking about the really interesting, really unique process that they went through in developing their latest play, Lady Bird, a process that relied in large part on the stories told to them by people in the neighborhood who then came forward and were part of the play itself.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I happened to have the chance, the opportunity to sit and watch some of the, you know, the rehearsal the other night and talk to some of the folks who were in the play. And I have to say during the rehearsal, I was really intrigued. Lori, you were like a taskmaster. You were pretty damn good.
That's right.
But the thing is that what was really impressive is that the camaraderie and the spirit of the people who were in there. And I looked at it and I thought, and I realized, wow, these are people who a year ago were walking down the street, coming home from work, doing what, they're people who are in your neighborhood, right? Mm-hmm. These are not professional actors by and large. And these were people who
right.
came in
That's
to
put
their, yeah, they put their heart and soul on the stage and they're working together to do this. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, last night we were practicing the curtain speech. I got a little choked up because they were all sitting behind me and I was talking about them and I was thinking, man, what a courageous thing when you're not, you know, aspiring to be an actor like 99% of the people here in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. You're just living your life and then you have the courage to get up in front of people and be vulnerable. That's really a courageous thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What has this meant for you, Yvonne?
Well, as Jay just mentioned, this group of people that are courageous enough to be on the stage but to tell their stories. Because mm-hmm. so often, you know, we always carry the mentality, well, everyone has a story to tell. But when you're able to bring it out and share it and now bring it onto the stage for everyone to see, I mean, I really hope that people that come can really feel that energy and leave with that.
And I think the goal had always been to allow this community to have a voice, mm-hmm. to give it a platform, to share their stories, because that's what theater does. That's the power of theater. You put it on stage and suddenly it elevates your life, suddenly has meaning, and you become part of a great canon and a great legacy of plays and theater makers. And it does something internally to you as an artist, as a human being, to suddenly just go, oh, wait, there's an artist living inside me and my ordinary story is moving people. Like, that's powerful.
You know, and it's interesting, too, because it's sort of like, you know, when you were talking about even the metaphorical images of what theater is all about, the idea of sitting around a campfire from the earliest days and sharing stories with one another, stories that sometimes, whether they carry a sort of a morality point or whether they carry a, you know, an idea of how you're going to survive when that big thing is out there trying to get you, you know, all of this. Mm-hmm. And when you bring that all together and you look at it and you think, wow, this is sort of, you know, not only is this doing this, but it's giving voice, because I was going to go back to something Yvonne said, and I know we're really running up on our time. I'm going to have to have you guys back, but very quickly, you're giving voice to people, not just people who are ordinary people, who everybody has a voice, but people who are told in this society, do not make your voice
right.
heard.
Absolutely. You know? Right.
Right.
Just suck it up and, you know, it's part of life. But it's interesting that when you do share it, what it really does to that person that's listening, that is in the same position most of the time, grew up with the same circumstances, and it's kind of giving them a voice and an acknowledgement that it's okay to express yourself.
Well, this is
yourself.
The thing. This society wants immigrants in particular to live in the shadows.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what I thought. Mm-hmm. This was really
yes,
important.
Absolutely. Right. It's cracking that wall of, you know, right. you don't get to have a voice, you remain silent. And suddenly, internally, with each individual who's on that stage, it's like, you know, the fear of jumping into that those deep waters of saying and speaking your truth is groundbreaking.
Mm-hmm. You know, one last thing, Michael, I love your intro this morning about Mandela. And you were telling me at the theater the other night about your experience living in South Africa and the small little theaters and how it worked. It was so fascinating. And this play, it's ironic to me because this play is really about sacrifice, which is, you know, who represents that more than Mandela? Mm-hmm. I mean, what irony that we're, you know, doing our little thing in the week that, you know, Mandela.
Yes, but clearly you missed part of my thing. We'll have to talk about that later. Anyway, I want to thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Michael.
All right, well, that brings us to the end of another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, way too numerous to mention by individual names, but thank each and every one of them nonetheless. All right, did a great job. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. I also want to thank my assistant producer today, Henry Carson, my production assistants, Jeff Pryor and Nellish Lalani, and my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson. And if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you want to follow me, you can do so at Facebook and Twitter. And just so people are kept apprised of where we stand in the quest to get those all so valuable likes, we're getting up there. We get few each week, but we need an onslaught of people liking us so we can get those superpowers and conquer the world, okay? All right. And remember, if you want to get a copy of the film that we talked about at the beginning of the show, the film Stepping into the Future on the Occasion of the Publication of Basics, a Celebration of Revolution and the Vision of the New World, you can get one by going to revolutionbooksnyc.org, okay? Go there and you can actually order up your copies. If you want to find more general information about the whole movement and the film and the whole movement, go to revcom.us. So we're going to go out now with Hurricane Season from Trombone Shorty. Talk to you again next week.